This week, IsoHunt loses copyright case in the USA. The word torrent is now banned on browser search bars. And $500 million bill for UK broadband customers to fight piracy. This is Pirate Party Radio Episode 9 for Thursday, December 31st, 2009.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control force. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, your source for news on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free speech and culture, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And the music in the background of today's show is from Patient Zero's upcoming album, Iconoclasm. Being released on January 7th, 2010, and you can download all his albums for free off of his website. It is great stuff, and this is definitely his best album yet. We've got some incoming messages from Deset. Hey, while you were discussing the issue of strong-handed tactics like browser hijacking, it reminded me of recent problems I've had with my computers. I'm not the super paranoid conspiracy theory type, but it seems to me when you download via torrent some copyrighted files, it seems like viruses and Trojans are getting more and more common and starting to really destroy systems. My thought, is it possible that some of the trackers or file uploaders are taking the side of the big corporations and purposefully taking copies of certain shows and releasing them with Trojans or viruses to track, or worse, destroy copyright infringers' computers? Can I get your thoughts on this, and if so, how to prevent this if there are any possibility to? Maybe in the end, no one is ripping them off TV or internet, and they're doing it themselves to generate revenue through court cases. Now that's a conspiracy theory. Of course you can't spell conspiracy without piracy. Regards to Set. Well, I really highly doubtful that the corporations are putting viruses on people's computers, because normally these viruses are just used for spamming purposes or to zombie computers so that they're under control of spam nets, and they just become botnets for spammers, really. So there really isn't a use for the corporations to take control of these computers in that manner. To track people, it's not terribly difficult for the corporations or the copyright holders to track people downloading. All they have to do is go on to they just need to start downloading one of these files and then take a look at the IP addresses of all the other people that they're connecting to, and they can see what progress you're at with your torrent. And they can see you're at 50% or 100%. And of course, when you're at 100%, they know that you have the full episode and not just a random assortment of bits and bytes. And so you also asked how to prevent yourself from getting these viruses and Trojans. Well, a lot of the better places on the internet to avoid viruses and Trojans, some of the better torrent sites have comment sections or thumbs up, thumbs down, and you just have to look at the comments to make sure that what you're downloading isn't a virus, because a lot of other people have downloaded it before you, threw it through the virus scanners and made sure that it is not a virus. And of course, anything with like an exe or an executable or something is potential for viruses to be contained in there. And if you're just downloading like a a video, an AVI or some other container format, MKV or something, they, as far as I know, they can't contain a virus unless they know how to exploit certain players by renaming a file .avi or .mkv, and that exploits a certain player that would run some arbitrary code, but that's quite complicated and they would have to go after a very common player. So that's quite uncommon. But just take a look at the comments and see if anybody said, don't download virus, virus, virus. And you should be okay. This is also from Deset. On that story about the SWAT officer's pager and the issue of privacy on work phones and work-related devices should always be considered read and opened. In my opinion, there should be no expectation of privacy in a workplace, or and more so for work-related devices, pagers, and cell phones. Do not send any personal information on equipment that isn't yours. And I fully agree with Deset. This is not even your equipment. You can't even confirm that somebody isn't spying on you with that equipment unless you have, you know, looked at it yourself. And definitely don't use, you know, I'm getting off track. I'll go back to her later. I have had many instances of being on the other end of this where an investigation needs to be made. And when it comes to an issue of not only theft of time, they're paying you at work to be working and not having cyber sex, but also theft of other things. My advice, use your own kit. Don't expect any privacy at work ever. More so in the law enforcement areas. And that's from Deset, and I fully agree with that sentiment. Use your own devices where you know the liability of sending information through it and how it's encrypted and how it's going to be sent, and that there's no third party man in the middle attack that can be recording what you're sending. And this next one from Fat Ninja, and this is regards to the last episode, Hollywood sets $10 billion box office record. Something I noticed about that story is the idea that the movie industry brought in over $10 billion in gross revenue, the key word being gross. Gross is in what is made before costs. After all, the average Hollywood blockbuster, James Cameron can fucking eat me, costs hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars to produce. In theory, a case could be made that piracy is cutting into the profit margin. But of course, they don't either actually bother to say anything other than piracy is costing them millions. So I would imagine that this is not the case. So yes, $10 billion is the box office gross revenues, and some movies are being cost more and more to be made, but you know, that's Hollywood's choice to make a movie for $500 million, whereas some movies only cost $10 million to produce, and it's up to them in the long run how much they want to invest in movies. And it has been, I have noticed that a lot of the movies that cost a lot of money make a lot of money as well, because they sink a whole bunch into special effects and they look wonderful on the screen, as long as they have a nice story to back them up, and then they might be a good movie. But the dazzlement wears off after the first showing of a lot of these blockbuster special effects movies, and I really don't feel like putting any money towards buying a DVD of it or a Blu-ray. To watch these special effects over and over again once is enough, and unless you're in the special effects department of movie making, and then you might get some decent behind-the-scenes footage on the special editions of the DVDs, and you can, you know, learn from them or something. If you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. So let's get on to the news. In pirate news, copyright news from the UK, broadband consumers to foot a $500 million bill to tackle online piracy. And this was sent in by Ad Nauseam. This is from the Times Online. .co.uk. Proposals to suspend the internet connections of those who repeatedly share music and films online will leave customers with a bill for £500 million, ministers have admitted. The Digital Economy Bill would force internet service providers to send warning letters to anyone caught swapping copyrighted material illegally, and to suspend or slow the connection of those who refuse to stop. ISPs say that interference with their customers' connection would add £25 a year to the broadband subscription. Ministers have not estimated the cost of the measures, but they say the cost of the initial letter-writing campaign, estimated at an extra £1.40 per subscription, will lead to 40,000 households giving up their internet connections. Impact assessments published alongside the bill predict that the measure will generate $1.7 billion in extra sales for the film and music industries over the next 10 years, as well as £350 million for the government in extra VAT. That's their tax. ISPs have called on the content industries to lessen the burden on broadband consumers by contributing to the costs. Charlie Dunstone, chief executive of Carphone Warehouse, whose subsidiary TalkTalk is the biggest consumer provider of broadband, said, "Broadband consumers shouldn't have to bail out the music industry. If they really think it's worth spending vast sums of money on these measures, then they should be footing the bill, not the consumer." British Telecom also stepped up its attack on the plans, which it represented collective punishment that goes against natural justice. John Petter, managing director of BT Retail's consumer division, said, "Put yourself in the shoes of a small businessman who has a rogue member of staff. Your internet access could get cut off because of the actions of one individual. It really feels like the UK is out on a limb with these proposals compared to the rest of the world." Mr. Petter said that the bill, which is being rushed to the Parliament before the general election next year, has been poorly thought out. He said the whole tenor of the way this is being introduced really makes us worried about this is all a false game. It's like the dangerous dogs legislation, which was introduced quickly and was not effective. The Conservatives, who are broadly supportive of the plan, also called on the government to spare the consumers the bulk of the costs. Jeremy Hunt, the Shadow Culture Secretary, said, "It is grossly unfair that Labour expects millions of innocent customers to pay extra each month because of the actions of a minority. By their own admission, this will make broadband unaffordable for tens of thousands of people, which flies in the face of government policy to increase take-up on the disadvantaged communities." A spokesman for the Department of Business, Innovation and Skills said many of the figures in the impact assessment for the digital economy bill are expressed in ranges, and some of the costs will be borne by the right holders and some by the ISPs. The overall benefits to the country far outweigh the costs. And it goes on and on. So it is completely unfair to put this burden of cost upon the consumer. It doesn't make sense that if the corporations want to fight piracy, like the RIAA or the equivalent in Britain, they should foot the bill to combat this. It shouldn't be put upon the end consumers who have no business dealings with these corporations, no direct business dealings possibly with these corporations to pay for their investigations into this. I mean, if I'm not downloading your music, why should I have to foot the bill to pay for your investigations into other people downloading your music? You're the one who is concerned. You should foot the bill, not the consumers. Censorship news from Australia. Breakdown of the Australian ISP filtering. This was sent in by Damonkin. This is from Liberitas.net, and it says, "This page contains an overview of the third version of the federal Labor government's mandatory ISP blocking slash censorship plan announced on the 15th of December 2009. A separate page provides more comprehensive detailed information about the government plans from late 2007 to date than this page. As shown below, the latest version of the government's mandatory ISP blocking plan has zero resemblance to the Labour's 2007 election policy, and such filtering blocking will be completely useless for a purpose of protecting children from material unsuitable for them. The government admits that it's mandatory for everyone's ISP blocking systems will only reduce the risk of inadvertent exposure to information material the government deems unsuitable for adults, a significantly broader range of information material than in most, possibly all, overseas Western democratic countries, and the vast majority of which is not illegal to view, access, or possess in most Australian states or territories." So it goes on to say all the different, it breaks it down completely, all the different things that it's going to be blocking. And it also provides a chart explaining the differences between what they propose when they were elected in 2007 and or their plans from 2007 and what is reflected now in the late 2009 policy. So it says, what is this list is what is mandatory for ISPs and all Australian residents component. And it says, this subsection contains a summary of the mandatory for everyone blocking component will and will not do and or aim to achieve. It will be mandatory for all adults. It will be completely useless for a purpose of protecting children from material unsuitable for them. It will block access to only material deemed unsuitable for adults to see, read, or hear by the Commonwealth Government, RC, restricted content material, hosted on overseas servers. ISP filtering reduces the risk of Australians being inadvertently exposed to RC-rated material when they are online, said Stephen Conroy. It will not block, nor even attempt to block, material unsuitable for children, other than a small amount of RC. It will not block any X18-plus pornography or R18-plus content. It will not block all prohibited potential and prohibited content that's on the ACMA's existing blacklist. It will not block nor attempt to block any access to RC, X18+, R18+ material available via non-web protocols, example, peer-to-peer networks, Usenet groups, IRC, FTP, instant messaging, email, and so on. It goes on and on about all the different things it will and will not block. So really, basically, I think it boils down to that it is a simple domain name block on web page content only. It is a very ineffective way to block material. And even if it was an effective way or ineffective way, why are you making the decisions to block or not block material? This should be put down. This should be something that people on the consumer end makes the choice to block or not block. If they want to see stuff that is not even illegal in Australia, that's up to them, the end consumer who is paying for this service, not for the government to do. The next one, copyright news from the U.S. and Canada. ISO Hunt loses U.S. lawsuit against movie studios. And this was sent in by DC. It's from torrentfreak.com. Following a 2006 complaint by several Hollywood studios, a U.S. federal court in California has ruled that ISO Hunt is guilty of inducing copyright infringement. Inducing. Due to similarities between this case and earlier ones involving Napster and Grokster, the judge decided there's no need to proceed to a full trial. Summary judgment was granted. In September 2006, just months after the infamous Pirate Bay raid, the U.S. movie studios turned their attention to ISO Hunt and other associated websites. Columbia, Disney, TriStar, 20th Century Fox, Universal, and Warner Brothers issued a complaint stating that ISO Hunt area owner Gary Fung operated file-sharing services and profited from copyright infringement. On December 21st, 2009, a U.S. federal court in California ruled that ISO Hunt is indeed guilty of violating U.S. copyright law by way of inducement, with the operators having engaged in purposeful, culpable expression and conduct aimed at promoting infringing uses of the websites. In noting similarities between this case and earlier ones involving both Napster and Grokster file-sharing services, Judge Stephen Wilson ruled that a full trial was not required and granted the plaintiff's request for a summary judgment. As noted by Michael Geist, the court also concluded that inducement liability and the safe harbor provisions under DMCA are incompatible. In this case, it means that since ISO Hunt was found to have induced infringement, it did not qualify for safe harbor. In common with the Mininova court defeated earlier this year, the court was critical of ISO Hunt and associated sites' staff actions and the site in their forums. The court said the clearest instance of encouraging users to commit infringement was the box office movies section of the site. These pages listed the top 20 grossing movies of the U.S. for which users were invited to upload associated torrents. By implementing this feature, the court, defendants engaged in direct solicitation of infringing activity. Furthermore, when IsoHunt generated torrent categories such as Top 20 Movies, the court said that the fact that these lists almost exclusively contained copyrighted works and that defendants never removed these lists indicated that IsoHunt knew about ongoing infringement yet failed to take action to stop it. Several other instances of staff members giving users advice on how to download copyrighted movies, including providing torrent links, rip copyrighted DVDs, and use software such as Peer Guardian, were also cited. Even the forum user ranking system didn't escape criticism, since user ranks included titles such as I Pirate, Therefore I Am, and All Day I Dream About Wares. The court concluded that the defendants promoted their users' infringing activities by consciously fostering a community that encouraged, indeed celebrated, copyright infringement. The court's judgment can be downloaded here or viewed online here. At 46 pages long, it's pretty heavy read, but it contains essential information for anyone interested in what can't be done when operating a torrent site or other similar services in the U.S. At this stage, it's unclear if IsoHunt will appeal the U.S. decision. But of course, in the meantime, its site is fully operational in Canada and will remain so for the foreseeable future. And story, I believe, last episode about a court case going against Google. And this is, and the IsoHunt is very, very similar to Google in the fact that it doesn't host the torrents. It only indexes them. It's the same as Google. But of course, the large companies aren't going to go after Google because they've got deep pockets. They're going to go after somebody like Gary Fung, who operates a small website who doesn't benefit from it greatly. So it's very strange that they were going against people talking about torrents. They want to silence the free speech of talking about these kinds of things. They were criticizing even mentioning torrents. And we're going to go to something a little bit later on in the show about talking about the word even, torrent, being erased from the internet. In this next story, open government news from the U.S. TSA threatens blogger who posted new screening directive. This is from Wired.com. Two bloggers received home visits from the Transport Security Administration agents Tuesday after they published a new TSA directive that revises screening procedures and puts new restrictions on passengers in the wake of recent bombing attempt by the so-called underwear bomber. Special agents from the TSA's Office of Inspection interrogated two U.S. bloggers, one of them an established travel columnist, and served them each with a civil subpoena demanding information on the anonymous source that provided the TSA document. The document, which the two bloggers published within minutes of each other, December 27th, was sent by TSA to airlines and airports around the world and described temporary new requirements for screening passengers through December 30th, including conducting pat-downs of legs and torsos. The document, which was not classified, was posted by numerous bloggers. Information from it was also published by some airline websites. They're saying it's a security document, but it was sent to every airport and airline, said Stephen Fritchling, one of the bloggers. It was sent to Islamabad, to Riyadh, and to Nigeria. So they're looking for information about a security document sent to 10,000 plus people internationally. You can't have a right to expect privacy after that. Transportation Security Administrator spokesman Suzanne Trevino said in a statement that security directives are not for public disclosure. TSA's Office of Inspections is currently investigating how recent security directives were acquired and published by parties who should not have been privy to this information, the statement said. Frischling, a freelance travel writer and photographer in Connecticut who writes for a blog for the KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, said the two agents who visited them about 7 p.m. Tuesday were armed and threatened him with a criminal search warrant if he didn't provide the name of his source. They also threatened to get him fired from his KLM job and indicated that they could get him designated a security risk, which would make him difficult to travel and do his job. They were indicating that there would be significant ramifications if I didn't cooperate, said Frischling, who was home alone with his three children when the agents arrived. It's not hard to intimidate someone when they're holding a three-year-old child in their hands. My wife works at night. I go to jail, and my kids are here with nobody. Frischling, who described some of the details of the visit on his personal blog, told Threat Level that the two agents drove to his house in Connecticut and from DHS offices in Massachusetts and New Jersey and didn't mention a subpoena until an hour into their visit. They came to the door and immediately were asking, "Who gave you this document? Why did you publish this document? And I don't think you know how much trouble you're in." It was very much a hardball tactic, he said. When they pulled a subpoena from the briefcase and told him that he was legally required to provide the information they requested, he said he needed to contact a lawyer. The agents said they'd sit outside his house until they gave him the information they wanted. Frischling said he received the document anonymously from someone using a Gmail account and determined, after speaking with an attorney, that he might as well cooperate with the agents since he had little information about the source and there was no federal shield law to protect him. The Gmail address consisted of the name Mike, followed by random letters and numbers. Frischling had already deleted the email after publishing the document, but he said he had learned from previous correspondence with the source that he had been hired a screener for the TSA in 2009. The agents searched through Frischling's BlackBerry and iPhone and questioned him about a number of phone numbers and messages in the devices. One number listed in his phone under Ice Mom was a quick dial to his mother in case of emergency. The agents misunderstood the acronym and became suspicious that it was a code for his anonymous source and asked if his source worked for ICE, the U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement. The agents said that they wanted to take an image of his hard drive. Frischling said that they had to go to Walmart to buy a hard drive, but when they returned, they were unable to get it to work. Frischling said that the keyboard on his laptop was no longer working after they tried to copy his files. The agents left around 11 p.m., but came back Wednesday morning with Frischling's consent and seized his laptop, which they promised to return after copying the hard drive. Frischling wrote in his blog that he decided to publish the TSA directive to clear up much of the confusion and speculation that was circulating among the public about changes that were being instituted in airport security procedures after a passenger unsuccessfully tried to ignite a bomb December 26 using a syringe and explosive chemicals hidden in his underwear. "We are a free society. Knowledge is power, and informing the masses allows for public conversation and collective understanding," Frischling wrote on his blog. "You can agree or disagree, but you need information to know if you want to agree or disagree. My goal is to inform and help people better understand what is happening, and as well to allow them to form their own opinions." So the government of the U.S. is trying to crack down on people discussing the new security measures of flying. Now, if we don't know what the new security measures of flying, how are we supposed to know what we can or cannot do or cannot bring on airplanes when we are traveling within the U.S. or traveling to or from the U.S.? Now, by silencing this information, the public is left clueless and uninformed about what is going on in their world. Now, this falls under the category of open government. And now this is directly opposed to open government. They're trying to silence what is happening in our travel industry and what we're allowed to do and not do. And if we go to the airport and we bring something that is not allowed, we're going to be patted down and interrogated like this guy has been interrogated. Now, the restrictions are out of control now. You can't bring anything that is remotely looking like a sharp object, any liquid, any kind of thing that has happened in the past. You have to take off your shoes. You have to be careful about every little thing. So this falls under open government, and we need to know this kind of information to live and work in the modern day society, so that we can be prepared for this kind of for being interrogated at the airport for bringing or not bringing something with you. And I don't want to go into a small room and be interrogated, so I would like to know what the new security measures are, rather than being locked down and surprised when you get to the airport. In privacy news, a new cloud-based hacking service can crack Wi-Fi passwords in 20 minutes. This is from infosecurity-magazine.com. A new online service launched by IT security researcher Moxie Marlinspike claims to crack vulnerable Wi-Fi passwords in about 20 minutes, a process that would take a dual-core PC around 120 hours. The cloud-based service, which costs $17 a time, reportedly uses a 400-node cluster of computers to run through around 130 million WPA password combinations in 20 minutes. To use the service, internet users upload a copy of the handshake file that occurs when a Wi-Fi device starts negotiating a link with the Wi-Fi access point, and the WPA cracker site, advises whether the password is crackable or not. The security research behind the new services said, whilst rainbow tables can be used to crack a WPA password, they have not been used in his database. In his explanation about rainbow tables, he noted that the Church of Wi-Fi has uploaded a collection to the net. The problem with rainbow tables, Marlon Spike said, that is since each handshake is salted with the ESSID of the network, you have to build a unique set of rainbow tables for each network that you potentially like to audit. Marlon Spike added that the Church of Wi-Fi has gone to heroic efforts to build tables for the 1,000 most popular ESSIDs, but we find this is often not enough. If someone has enabled WPA encryption on their wireless network, chances are that they've changed the ESSID to something not very common as well. Interestingly, Marlon Spike appears to develop the code that drives the 400-node network himself, rather than use the OpenWall directory as a number of experts have when developing their own personal software to compete with WPA cracking process. In the services FAQ, Marlon Spike that said that in our experience, the open wall dictionaries were tailored more specifically for Unix logins than for WPA networks. Our dictionary was meticulously compiled with WPA cracking in mind and includes word combination, phrases, numbers, symbols, and elite speak, and has worked quite well for us, and now we're hoping that it could be helpful for you. And from the FAQ on their website, it also continues, "But I use WPA2, so it's cool, right? Actually, while WPA2 introduced CCMP mode as a replacement for the problematic TKIP, when run with authentication based on pre-shared keys, PSK, it is still vulnerable to dictionary attacks. Our service works against both WPA and WPA2 when PSK is being used." So this is a very good audit for your wireless network, if you are interested in protecting your privacy, in your data privacy, and your internal communications within your house. So it is a charged service, but if somebody's sniffing outside of your house and runs your network through this service and they're able to get your password, then you are vulnerable. So you want to look into this story, and you want to look into what your router is capable of so you can keep your private documents to yourself. So check that out. Copyright news from Argentina, sent in by DC. Restoration of French philosopher's work online in Argentina seen as an opening. This is from ip-watch.org. An Argentinian judge's recent decision to drop charges against a philosophy professor for alleged copyright infringement is seen as a stepping stone to drawing attention to copyright issues in Latin America, according to advocates. Professor Horacio Potel curated open-source websites to post foreign philosophers' work in Spanish. The websites were named Nietzsche in Spanish, Heidegger in Spanish, and Derrida in Spanish. On November 13th, the Argentinian justice decided that Potel's actions did not justify penal prosecution, and he was declared free of charges, according to the Fundación Via Libre, an Argentinian non-governmental organization focused on civil rights in the digital area, who posted the court decision on their website. In December 2008, French publishing company Les Éditions du Minuit, owner of the rights on some of Derrida's books, lodged a complaint then passed on to the French embassy in Argentina. The Argentina Book Chamber then started a legal action against Potel. The professor had told Intellectual Property Watch in a in a previous interview that access to Derrida's work was very difficult in Argentina because of the cost of books imported from Spain, priced in euros, and because of the scarcity of bookstores in the countryside. The photocopying of textbooks is a major issue for academics and students. Roberto Verloza of Copy South had told Intellectual Property Watch previously. Our legal system, Beatriz Busenji of Via Libera told Intellectual Property Watch this week, this case will be not considered a jurisprudence, but the case as a whole helped to spread the word about copyright issues. One of the main results is now social sciences universities here are aware of this conflict and are ready to commit to open the debate around copyright. Contacted by email, Les Editions de Minuit said they were not aware of Argentinian judicial decision. Both of the websites that were the objects of the lawsuit are active again, and you can check out the websites there. In copyright news, Conduit bans torrent and P2P words on browser toolbars. The words torrent and other peer-to-peer words. This is from torrentfreak.com. Conduit, the lead provider in community toolbars for Internet Explorer, Mozilla Firefox, and the Safari web browsers, have decided to ban the use of P2P-related words on their services. Toolbars using torrent, or P2P, are banned as they apparently violate the terms and conditions of the Conduit's publisher's agreement. A few years ago, when community toolbars started to pop up at several torrent sites and elsewhere on the internet, we decided to create Torrent Freak Toolbar featuring our RSS feed. And this is Torrent Freak talking. The toolbar was never promoted in public because it was just as useless as most toolbars, and up until today, it had just one install. In fact, we totally forgot that it still existed until Conduit sent us an email yesterday, which informed that our publisher agreement has been terminated for inappropriate words. Inappropriate words. Apparently, Conduit had decided that the torrent in Torrent Freak is a direct violation in terms and conditions. It has recently come to our attention that the name and the content of the community toolbar that you publish contains materials, such as marks, signs, images, or text, that are not allowed in the Conduit platform, specifically Torrent, Emule, and P2P. Conduit wrote Torrent Freak in an email. The company further states that using such words is considered as a violation in terms and conditions of the publisher agreement, and that our long-standing and fruitful relationship will be terminated immediately. Just out of curiosity and to find out what terms or conditions we could possibly have violated, we skimmed through the agreement, but to no avail. There is no mention of a list of forbidden words as mentioned in the publisher agreement. Not every torrent toolbar is considered evil, though. The popular torrent search bar and torrent toolbar that both use Conduit still seem to be working. Similarly, Mininova told Torrent Freak that they haven't been contacted by Conduit either. Of course, we don't mind that Conduit pulled the plug in our toolbar, but the reason for the termination is just so ridiculous we simply had to bring it up. We can only hope that the companies will refrain from using such arbitrary ban lists. Conduit has been contacted for a comment on their radical censorship policy, but thus far, we haven't been heard back from the company. So, watch for this in the future, the word torrent being banned. Now, Torrent Freak isn't excellent website for copyright news, and they're banning their search bar just because it has the word torrent in it. Now, this is a private company and they can do whatever they like with their software that they distribute or host on their site. But if they don't spell it out in the initial agreement when they make the agreements with people that are using their service, it muddies the waters a little bit. Like, how are you supposed to know whether a certain word is going to be banned if they don't let you know that a certain word is going to be banned in the future, and they're going to pull the plug on something that you made through their website. A little frustrating, I can see, from torrentfreak.com's perspective. Copyright news from Italy. BitTorrent sites may be censored in Italy. So along the same vein, this is also from torrentfreak.com. The Italian Supreme Court has ruled that ISPs can be forced to block BitTorrent sites, even though they're not hosted in Italy or operated by Italian citizens. According to the decision by the Supreme Court, sites offering torrent files that link to copyright material are engaged in criminal activity. The Supreme Court ruling follows a nationwide block of the Pirate Bay in August 2008, when a decree from a public prosecutor instructed ISPs to censor the site. As a result, millions of Italians were banned from accessing the world's largest BitTorrent tracker. The Pirate Bay chose to appeal the decision and won the court case. The Court of Bergamo ruled that no foreign website can be censored for alleged copyright infringement, and the block was lifted. However, 2 months ago, the Supreme Court nullified this victory, opening up the possibility for anti-piracy groups to censor the Pirate Bay and many other torrent sites in Italy. This week, the Supreme Court detailed its decision. According to the verdict, BitTorrent sites that host torrent files are playing a significant role in the downloading and uploading process of their users. By doing so, they're more than an agnostic search engine such as Google. The fact that a site is not hosted in Italy or operated by Italians is irrelevant, according to the court. The site is visited by many Italians who, in part, use it to share copyrighted material, the Supreme Court argued. With this verdict in hand, copyright holders can now request the Pirate Bay and other BitTorrent sites to be filtered by their internet service providers. The Pirate Bay is first in line, as its case now has been sent back to the Court of Bergamo. The Pirate Bay lawyers Giovanni Battista Gallus, Giuseppe Campanelli, and Francesco Micosi have informed Torrent Freak that the site will remain accessible for now. There will be another hearing before the Court of Bergamo, they told us, which will have to decide again whether to block the Pirate Bay in Italy or not. We will go again before the Court of Bergamo where we have an ample grounds to defend the Pirate Bay, the lawyers noted, adding, we could even appeal the new decision before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decision has nevertheless set a dangerous precedent. If the Pirate Bay loses its case, it is expected that many other BitTorrent sites will face a shutdown order in the future. Now, I use the Pirate Bay for hosting some of my videos that I produce. And so if the Pirate Bay gets blocked in Italy, these people won't have as simple of access to get to the videos that I produce. And this is a little frustrating that they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater when blocking torrent sites. There are completely legitimate uses for these torrent sites, and they're very handy for hosting people's information, especially large files, such as like half a gig file videos that such as I host on these websites, and these people won't have the search capability to get to those video files. And where if all these torrent sites are blocked, how are these people going to look for new material to listen to and to watch for free? And I'm not talking about big blockbuster Hollywood movies. I'm talking about everyday artists that are distributing their works through these torrent sites. They're just indiscriminately banning torrent sites on the word of lawyers and getting them totally shut down so that they can't access the legitimate things. There's tons of legitimate things being hosted by the creators of the works on places like Pirate Bay. So it's very unfortunate for Italy there. Privacy news from the U.S. Better airport scanners delayed by privacy fears. It's from cbc.ca, and this was posted in the Pirate Party Canada forums by Anthony. High-tech security scanners that might have prevented the Christmas Day attempt to blow up a jetliner has been installed in only a number of small number of airports around the world, in large part because of privacy concerns over the way the machines see through clothing. The body scanning technology is in at least 19 U.S. airports, while European officials have generally limited it to test runs. Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the Nigerian accused of trying to ignite explosives aboard a Northwest Airlines jet as it was coming for a landing in Detroit, did not go through such a scan where his flight began, at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport. The full-body scanner could have been helpful in this case, absolutely, said Evert van Zwol, head of the Dutch Pilots Association. But the technology has raised significant concerns among privacy watchdogs because it can show the body's contour with embarrassing clarity. Those fears have slowed the introduction of the machines. Jay Stanley, public educator director for the American Civil Liberties Union's Technology and Liberty Program said the machines essentially perform virtual strip searches that see through your clothing and reveal the size and shape of your body. Abdul Mutallab passed through a routine security check at the gate in Amsterdam before boarding, officials said. He is believed to have tucked in his into his trousers or underwear a black a small bag holding PETN explosive powder and possibly a liquid detonator. Because such items won't set off metal detectors, the U.S. Transport Security Administration, part of Department of Homeland Security, has begun installing two types of advanced scanning machines that provide a more detailed picture. These machines, which can cost six figures each, screen airline passengers without physical contact. They can reveal plastic or chemical explosives and non-metallic weapons. Such scanners provide the best protection for the widest range of threats, said Joe Reese, Vice President of Marketing for American Science and Engineer Incorporated. The company makes machines for prisons, military agencies, foreign customs patrols, and other customers, but does not have a contract with TSA. TSA deployed 40 millimeter wave machines, which use radio waves to produce a three-dimensional image based on energy reflected back from the body. Six of those machines, which are made by L3 Communication Holdings Incorporated, are used for what the TSA calls primary screenings at six U.S. airports. This means passengers go through the scans instead of a metal detector, although they can elect to receive a pat-down search from a security officer instead. The remainder of the machines are being used at 13 U.S. airports for secondary screenings of passengers who set off a metal detector. Travelers can opt for a pat-down instead of those instances as well. So it goes on detailing more about the technology behind the scanners at the airport. So it is quite an invasion. So it really rests upon how these scans are being used, whether they're being recorded, who is looking at them, and to what detail does it show the body. And how much people are concerned about this, whether they are effective also in being able to thwart such future terrorist actions. Now, this is quite a balance on between privacy and security, and we'll see how it plays out in the coming months. Copyright news from Chile. Chile resists U.S. pressure and rejects ISP filtering. It's from ZeroPaid.com. Bill would have required to ISPs to block content after a simple warning letter by copyright holders alleging copyright infringement, as well as to keeping them identifying data of those who receive it. The Chilean House of Representatives have formally rejected the latest attempt by Chilean President Michelle Bachelet to reform that country's copyright laws to include ISP-level content filtering. President Bachelet has argued that it is necessary in order to comply with the free trade agreement with the United States. But critics pointed out that it's not being true that the U.S. is nowhere near ever having a similar system in place, nor is likely to ever have one. Many voted against the bill because it would have allowed ISPs and not the courts to determine copyright infringement. Specifically, they cite Article 10, which reads, "The provider is aware that in good faith alleged breaches of rights established in this act shall be exempt from liability, whether by letter notifies the alleged offender, if he announces that it agrees with the discretion of the service provider, or be silent for more than 10 days from the date of communication. The service provider may block the material hosted on their systems that may be subject of reproach. It is within this period the alleged violator in writing to insist that such content will continue to be transmitted. They cannot be blocked by the service provider, and the service provider is exempt from any responsibility." ISPs would have been responsible for verifying copyright infringement and would likely be introduced mechanisms to be more proactive with their efforts to ensure compliance and decrease liability, meaning active content filtering in violation of customers' privacy. Another article, Article 12, would have required ISPs to keep identifying data of those accused of copyright infringement for at least 6 months. Critics say it's unfair since it's only an allegation and no similar treatment is required for people accused, yet not convicted of other crimes. It says, I'm glad to see the Chilean legislators were able to resist efforts by their president to institute such draconian copyright laws, but what's disturbing is that they were made in my name. The U.S. government, at behest of greedy entertainment industry cartels, is trying to muscle smaller countries into enacting legislation that is entirely necessary. Is Chilean online piracy really having a detrimental impact on U.S. copyright holders like the MPAA and RIAA? I highly doubt it. And privacy news, an ebook buyer's guide to privacy. And this is from EFF.org. So take a read before you buy any ebooks to see what you're exposing yourself to. It says, as we count down to the end of 2009, the emerging star of this year's holiday shopping season is shaping up to be the electronic book reader, or e-reader, from Amazon's Kindle to Barnes & Noble's forthcoming Nook. E-readers are starting to transform how we buy and read books in the same way MP3s changed how we buy and listen to music. Unfortunately, e-readers' technology also presents significant new threats to readers' privacy. E-readers possess the ability to report back substantial information about their users' reading habits and locations to the corporations that sell them. And yet none of the major e-readers manufacturers explain to consumers in clear, unequivocal language what data is being collected about them and why. As a first step towards addressing these problems, EFF has created a first draft of our buyer's guide to e-book privacy. We've examined the privacy policies for the major e-readers on the market to determine what information they reserve the right to collect and share. For example, Google's new Google Book search project has the ability to track reading habits at an unprecedented level of granularity. In particular, according to the proposed Google Books privacy policy, web servers will automatically log each book and page you search for and read, how long you viewed it for, and what book or page you continued on to next. When you use Google Books, we receive log information similar to what we receive in web search. This includes the query term or page request, which may include specific pages within a book you're browsing, internet protocol address, browser type, browser language, and the date and time of your request, and one or more cookies that may uniquely identify your browser. Because users must have a Google account in order to purchase or view books, Google maintains a dossier via its web history service of all books purchased unless the user gives up the right to view a book he or she has already bought. Physical e-reader devices pose similar threats to reader privacy. For example, the Kindle does not sell, but rather licenses the books, magazines, and other materials offered for wireless download through its Kindle store, which can only be used on a particular device. This implicitly requires Amazon to know what reading material a user has licensed at any given time. Even more disturbing, however, is the broad latitude Amazon gives itself to track of how many customers are using their device. From the Kindle licensing agreement on terms of use. Information received. The device software will provide Amazon with data about your device and its interaction with service, i.e. wireless connection, purchases through Kindle store, etc. Such as available memory, uptime, log files, and signal strength, and information related to the content of your device and your use of it, such as automatic bookmarking of the last page read and content deletions from the device. Annotations, bookmarks, notes, highlights, or similar markings you make in your device are backed up through the service. Information we receive is subject to the Amazon.com privacy notice. In other words, your Kindle will periodically send information about you to Amazon. But exactly what information is sent? Amazon's wording, information related to the content of your device and your use of it, reads so broadly that it appears to allow Amazon to track all content that users put on the device, regardless of whether that content is purchased from Amazon. Some security researchers have indicated the Kindle may be even tracking the user's GPS location. Is this the future of reading? So the page goes on and provides a nice handy chart of each of the ebooks and equivalent type devices and technologies and breaks it down at what they track and what they don't track. So definitely take a look at that before purchasing any of these devices. And the last story is this, the year in tech law and policy, my annual A to Z review. And this is from Michael Geist's page. The past 12 months in law and technology were exceptionally active with new legislation, Canada Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission hearings, national consultations and very public battles over digital issues. My weekly technology law column, Toronto Star version, homepage version, takes a look back at 2009 from A to Z. Now I'm going to just run through a couple of these. A is for the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the secret copyright treaty that generated opposition at home and abroad as details on proposed language leaked out. B is for Chet Baker, the former jazz great and current lead plaintiff in a $6 billion copyright class lawsuit filed against the Canadian recording industry for its failure to pay artists for the use of their work. C is for the Conference Board of Canada, which withdrew three intellectual property reports after acknowledging they contained plagiarized material. D is for Drugs for Africa legislation, which unexpectedly passed second reading in the House of Commons and will be considered by a committee next year. E is for eBay power sellers who face an aggressive campaign by the Canada Revenue Agency to collect unpaid GST. That's a tax in Canada. The campaign followed a successful legal effort to force eBay to disclose the sellers' identities. F is for Facebook, which agreed to make significant privacy changes following a well-publicized investigation by the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. So this is a good list, kind of doing a wrap-up of 2009. So take a look through those stories and see which ones that you recognize or maybe ones that you've missed, and you can go search them out. Now on to Pirate Party news. Some sad news from Austria and Pirate Party. The obituary of the founder of Pirate Party Austria. The Pirate Party Austria regrets to announce that its founder and former board member, Florian Hufsky, deceased on December 16th. Thanks to Florian Hufsky's pioneering spirit, Austria was one of the first countries with its own pirate party, founded in summer 2006. Back then, he was one of the few brave people who stood up against those who wanted to enforce economic or governmental interests by sacrificing civil rights. Florian's enthusiasm was a huge inspiration for pirates on a national and as well as an international level. The pirate movement would not be the same today if it wasn't for Florian's untiring support at the beginning. One of his greatest successes is the organization of the International Pirate Conference in Vienna in summer 2007. That conference was crucial for the inner solidarity of the pirate movement and was the foundation for many more conferences in different countries. Many pirates in Austria, as well as in other countries, mourn Florian Hufsky, who was not only a great role model, but more importantly, a very good friend. Together we condole with the bereaved. And Pirate Party news from Australia. Free memberships are available. Pirate Party Australia is pleased to announce that the Australian Online Solutions is sponsoring 10 lots of membership fees for those who need a bit of help. If you feel you fit into this category, please email membership@pirateparty.org.au and let us know why. Be quick, because these spots will go very quickly. If you'd like to contribute the way Australian Online Solutions has, also email membership@pirateparty.org.au and we can go from there. If your fees are sponsored, you still need to submit an application form as normal. I'm sure that the sponsor would also appreciate a thank you tweet or blog post if possible. And from Pirate Party News from the UK, Pirate Party, the one to watch in 2010. JWT, one of the world's largest advertising companies, every year publishes a list of upcoming trends. This year's 100 Things to Watch in 2010 also includes the Pirate Party. While critics dismiss them as just a bunch of kids proclaiming the right to free file sharing, this grassroots movement is broadening to embrace the issues of the digital age. Censorship, privacy rights, and civil liberties on the web. The Pirate Party, active in 28 countries in Europe and North America, is already the third largest in Sweden, home of the Pirate Bay, the controversial file sharing site, where one member was elected to the European Parliament last June. And they actually made a mistake there. There's actually two. that were elected. JWT's analysis is right. Last June, over half of male Swedish voters under 25 voted for the Pirate Party. These people are digital natives. They've never known a time when the net wasn't there, and they see it as a fundamental part of their lives. Threatening to cut off people's net access is therefore seen as a vastly disproportionate punishment, almost akin as to cutting off someone's tongue. While young female voters also tend to vote Pirate Party, compared to older voters, they do so less than male voters. The Pirate Movement's task, therefore, is twofold. To get women to vote for us in the same numbers that men do, which should be doable since women use the internet as much as men, and to make sure that each year's intake of new 18-year-old voters supports us while existing supporters continue to support us. If we do that across Europe, we'll win. And primary elections for the Swedish Pirate Party are underway. And I extracted this from translating through Google. If you live in Sweden, go check out the Pirate Party's website for details on voting for the party lists for the parliamentary elections for 2010. The voting is open until January 17th, 2010 at midnight. And I've got a free game for people to check out. It's the free culture game, A Playable Theory. That's a very simple, short little game that you can play. It's from moleindustria.org. And the free culture game is a game about the struggle between free culture and copyright. Create and defend the common knowledge from the vectorial class. Liberate the passive consumers from the domain of the market. So give it a try. It's a fun little flash game to play for a couple minutes and an interesting way to visualize the free culture idea. So if you have any news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. So thank you for listening. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.